But we're going to be all right, he thought. We're going to get back. The buffeting began then, the whipping, slamming, side to side, flailing, as it tried one final time to shake them off and lead them outside. And Richie felt his grip slipping. He heard its guttural roar of triumph and concentrated his being on holding, but he continued to slip. He bit down frantically, but its tongue seemed to be losing substance and reality. It seemed to be becoming gossamer. Help! Richie screamed. I'm losing it! Help! Somebody help us! 5. Eddie. Eddie was half aware of what was happening. He felt it somehow, saw it somehow, but as if through a gauzy curtain. Somewhere, Bill and Richie were struggling to come back. Their bodies were here, but the rest of them, the real of them, was far away. He had seen the spider turn to impale Bill with its stinger, and then Richie had run forward, yelling at it in that ridiculous Irish cop's voice he used to use. Only Richie must have improved his act a hell of a lot over the years, because this voice sounded eerily like Mr. Nell from the old days. The spider had turned toward Richie, and Eddie had seen its unspeakable red eyes bulge in their sockets. Richie yelled again, this time in his Pancho Vanilla voice, and Eddie had felt the spider scream in pain. Ben yelled hoarsely as a split appeared in its hide along the line of one of its scars from the last time. A stream of ichor, black as crude oil, sprayed out. Richie had started to say something else, and his voice had begun to diminish, like the fade at the end of a pop song. His head had rolled back on his neck, his eyes fixed on its eyes. The spider grew quiet again. Time passed. Eddie had no idea just how much. Richie and the spider stared at each other. Eddie sensed the connection between them, felt a swirl of talk and emotion somewhere far away. He could make out nothing exactly, but sensed the tones of things and colors and hues. Bill lay slumped on the floor, nose and ears bleeding, fingers twitching slightly, his long face pale, his eyes closed. The spider was now bleeding in 4 or 5 places, badly hurt again. Badly hurt, but still dangerously vital, and Eddie thought, why are we just standing around here? We could hurt it while it's occupied with Richie. Why doesn't somebody move, for Christ's sake? He sensed a wild triumph, and that feeling was clearer, sharper, closer. They're coming back, he wanted to shout, but his mouth was too dry, his throat too tight. They're coming back. Then Richie's head began to turn slowly from side to side. His body seemed to ripple inside his clothes. His glasses hung on the end of his nose for a moment, then fell off and shattered on the stone floor. The spider stirred, its spiny legs making a dry clittering on the floor. Eddie heard it cry out in terrible triumph, and a moment later, Richie's voice burst clearly into his head. Help! I'm losing it! Somebody help me! Eddie ran forward then, yanking his aspirator from his pocket with his good hand, his lips drawn back in a grimace, his breath whistling painfully in and out of a throat that now felt the size of a pinhole. Crazily, his mother's face danced before him, and she was crying, Don't go near that thing, Eddie! Don't go near it! Things like that give you cancer. Shut up, Ma, Eddie screamed in a high, shrieky voice, all the voice he had left. The spider's head turned toward the sound, its eyes momentarily leaving Richie's. Here, Eddie howled in his fading voice. Here, have some of this. He leaped at it, triggering the aspirator at the same time. And for an instant, all his childhood belief in the medicine came back to him. The childhood medicine that could solve everything, that could make him feel better when the bigger boys roughed him up, or when he was knocked over in the rush to get through the doors when school let out, or when he had to sit on the edge of the Tracker Brothers' vacant lot, out of the game because his mother wouldn't allow him to play baseball. It was good medicine, strong medicine. And as he leaped into the spider's face, smelling its foul yellow stench, feeling himself overwhelmed by its single-minded fury and determination to wipe them all out, he triggered the aspirator into one of its ruby eyes. He felt heard its scream. No rage this time, only pain, a horrid screaming agony. He saw the mist of droplets settle on that blood-red bulge, saw the droplets turn white where they landed, saw them sink in as a splash of carbolic acid would sink in. He saw its huge eye begin to flatten out like a bloody egg yolk and run in a ghastly stream of living blood and ichor and maggoty pus.
Come home now, Bill,
He screamed with the last of his voice, and then he struck it. He felt its noisome heat baking into him. He felt a terrible wet warmth and realized that his good arm had slipped into the spider's mouth. He triggered the aspirator again, shooting the stuff right down its throat this time, right down its rotten, evil, stinking gullet, and there was sudden flashing pain, as clean as the drop of a heavy knife, as its jaws closed and ripped his arm off at the shoulder. Eddie fell to the floor, the ragged stump of his arm spraying blood, faintly aware that Bill was getting shakily to his feet, that Richie was weaving and stumbling toward him like a drunk at the end of a long, hard night. Ed's far away, unimportant. He could feel everything running out of him along with his life's blood. All the rage, all the pain, all the fear, all the confusion and hurt. He supposed he was dying, but he felt, oh God, he felt so lucid. So clear, like a window pane which has been washed clean and now lets in all the gloriously frightening light of some unsuspected dawning. The light. Oh, God, that perfect rational light that clears the horizon somewhere in the world every second. Ed's. Oh, my God, Bill. Ben, someone. He's lost his arm. His... He looked up at Beverly and saw she was crying, the tears coursing down her dirty cheeks as she got an arm under him. He became aware that she had taken off her blouse and was trying to staunch the flow of blood, and that she was screaming for help. Then he looked at Richie and licked his lips, fading, fading back, becoming clearer and clearer, emptying out all of the impurities flowing out of him so he could become clear, so that the light could flow through. And if he had had enough time, he could have preached on this, he could have sermonized. Not bad, he would begin. This is not bad at all. But there was something else he had to say first. Richie, he whispered. What? Richie was down on his hands and knees, staring at him desperately. Don't call me Ed's, he said, and smiled. He raised his left hand slowly and touched Richie's cheek. Richie was crying. You know, I... Eddie closed his eyes, thinking how to finish, and while he was still thinking it over, he died. 6. Derry, 7 to 9 a.m. By 7 a.m., the wind speed in Derry had picked up to about 37 miles an hour, with gusts up to 45. Harry Brooks, a National Weather Service forecaster based at Bangor International Airport, made an alarmed call to NWS headquarters in Augusta. The winds, he said, were coming out of the west and blowing in a queer semicircular pattern he had never seen before. But it looked to him more and more like some weird species of pocket hurricane, one that was limited almost exclusively to Derry Township. At 7:10, the major Bangor radio stations broadcast the first severe weather warnings. The explosion of the power transformer at Tracker Brothers had killed the power all over Derry on the Kansas Street side of the Barrens. At 7:17, a hoary old maple on the old Cape side of the Barrens fell with a terrific rending crash, flattening a night owl store on the corner of Merritt Street and Cape Avenue. An elderly patron named Raymond Fogarty was killed by a toppling beer cooler. This was the same Raymond Fogarty who, as the minister of the First Methodist Church of Derry, had presided over the burial rites of George Denbrough in October of 1957. The maple also pulled down enough power lines to knock out the power in both the old Cape and the somewhat more fashionable Sherborne Woods development beyond it. The clock in the steeple of the Grace Baptist Church had chimed neither 6 nor 7. At 7:20, 3 minutes after the maple fell in the old Cape, and about 1 hour and 15 minutes after every toilet and domestic drain over there had suddenly reversed itself, the clock in the tower chimed 13 times. A minute later, a blue-white stroke of lightning struck the steeple. Heather Libby, the minister's wife, happened to be looking out the window of the parsonage's kitchen at the time, and she said that the steeple exploded like someone loaded it up with dynamite. Whitewashed boards, chunks of beams, and clockwork from Switzerland showered down on the street. The ragged remains of the steeple burned briefly and then guttered out in the rain, which was now a tropical downpour. The streets leading downhill into the downtown shopping area foamed and ran. The progress of the canal under Main Street had become a steady, shaking thunder that made people look at each other uneasily. At 7:25, with the titanic crash of the Grace Baptist steeple still reverberating all over Derry, The janitor who came into Wally's spa every morning except Sunday to swap the place out saw something which sent him screaming into the street. The fellow, who had been an alcoholic ever since his first semester at the University of Maine, lo, these 11 years ago, was paid a pittance for his services. His real pay, it was understood, was his absolute freedom to finish up anything left in the beer kegs under the bar from the night before. Richie Tozier might or might not have remembered him. He was Vincent Caruso Taliendo, better known to his fifth grade contemporaries as Boogers Taliendo. As he was mopping up that apocalyptic morning in Derry, working his way gradually closer and closer to the serving area, he saw all seven of the beer taps. Three Bud, two Narragansett, one Schlitz, known more familiarly to the bleary patrons of Wally's as Slitz, and one Miller Lite, nod forward as if pulled by seven invisible hands. Beer ran from them in streams of gold-white foam. Vince started forward, thinking not of ghosts or phantoms, but of his morning's dividend going down the drain. Then he skidded to a stop, eyes widening, and a wailing, horrified scream rose in the empty, beer-smelling cave that was Wally's spa. Beer had given way to arterial streams of blood. It swirled in the chromium drains, overflowed, and ran down the side of the bar in little streamlets. Now hair and chunks of flesh began to splurt out of the beer taps. Boogers Taliendo watched this, transfixed, not even able to summon enough strength to scream again. Then there was a thudding, toneless blast as one of the beer kegs under the counter exploded. All of the cupboard doors under the bar swung wide. Greenish smoke, like the aftermath of a magician's trick, began to drift out of them. Boogers had seen enough. Screaming, he fled into the street, which was now a shallow canal. He fell on his butt, got up, and threw a terrified glance back over his shoulder. One of the bar windows blew out with a loud shooting gallery sound. Wickers of broken glass whistled all around Vince's head. A moment later, the other window exploded. Once again, he was miraculously untouched. But he decided on the spur of the moment that the time had come to see his sister up Eastport. He started off at once, and his journey to the Derry town limits and beyond would make a saga in itself. But suffice it to say that he did eventually get out of town. Others were not so lucky. Aloysius Nell, who had turned 77 not long since, was sitting with his wife in the parlor of their home on Strapham Street, watching the storm pound Derry. At 7:32, he suffered a fatal stroke. His wife told her brother a week later that Aloysius dropped his coffee cup on the rug, sat bolt upright, his eyes wide and staring, and screamed, "Here, hear me, fine girl. Just what in the hell do you think you're doing? Belay that guff before I snatch your petty skirt." Then he fell out of his chair, smashing his coffee cup under him. Maureen Nell, who knew well how bad his ticker had been for the last 3 years, understood immediately that all was over with him, and after loosening his collar, she had run for the telephone to call Father McDowell. But the phone was out of order. A funny noise like a police siren was all it would make. And so, although she knew it was probably a blasphemy she would have to answer for to St. Peter, she had attempted to give him the last rites herself. She felt confident, she told her brother, that God would understand even if St. Peter didn't. Aloysius had been a good husband and a good man, and if he drank too much, that was only the Irish in him coming out. At 7:49, a series of explosions shook the Derry Mall, which stood on the site of the defunct Kitchener Ironworks. No one was killed. The mall didn't open until 10, and the five-man janitorial squad hadn't been due to arrive until 8. And on such a morning as this, very few of them would have shown up anyway. A team of investigators later dismissed the idea of sabotage. They suggested, rather vaguely, that the explosions had probably been caused by water which had seeped into the mall's electrical system. Whatever the reason, no one was going to go shopping at the Derry Mall for a long time. One explosion totally wiped out Zale's jewelry store. Diamond rings, ID bracelets, strings of pearls, trays of wedding rings, and Seiko digital watches flew everywhere in a hail of bright, sparkly trinkets. A music box flew the length of the East Corridor and landed in the fountain outside of the J.C. Penney's, where it briefly played a bubbly rendition of the theme from Love Story before shutting down. The same blast tore a hole through the Baskin-Robbins next door, turning the 31 flavors into ice cream soup that ran away along the floors in cloudy runnels. The blast which tore through Sears lifted off a chunk of the roof, and the rising wind sailed it away like a kite. It came down 1,000 yards away, slicing cleanly through the silo of a farmer named Brent Kilgallen. Kilgallen's 16-year-old son rushed out with his mother's Kodak and took a picture. The National Enquirer bought it for $60, which the boy used to buy 2 new tires for his Yamaha motorcycle. A third explosion ripped through hit or miss, sending flaming skirts, jeans, and underwear out into the flooded parking lot. And a final explosion tore open the mall branch of the Dairy Farmers Trust like a rotted box of crackers. A chunk of the bank's roof was also torn off. Burglar alarms went off with a bray that would not be silenced until the security system's independent wiring hookup was shorted out 4 hours later. Loan contracts, banking instruments, deposit slips, cash drawer chits, and money manager forms were lifted into the sky and blown away by the rising wind. And money. Tens and twenties mostly, with a generous helping of fives and a soupçon of fifties and hundreds. Better than $75,000 blew away, according to the bank's officers. Later, after a mass shakeup in the bank's executive structure and an FSLIC bailout, some would admit, strictly off the record, of course, that it had been more like $200,000. A woman in Haven Village named Rebecca Paulson found a $50 bill fluttering from her back door welcome mat, two twenties in her birdhouse, and a hundred plastered against an oak tree in her backyard. She and her husband used the money to make an extra 2 payments on their Bombardier Skidoo. Dr. Hale, a retired doctor who had lived on West Broadway for nearly 50 years, was killed at 8 a.m. Dr. Hale liked to boast that he had taken the same 2-mile walk from his West Broadway home and around Dairy Park and the elementary school for the last 25 of those 50 years. Nothing stopped him, not rain, sleet, hail, howling nor'easters, or sub-zero cold. He set out on the morning of May 31st, in spite of his housekeeper's worried fussings. His exit line from the world, spoken back over his shoulder as he went through the front door, pulling his hat firmly down to his ears, was, "Don't be so goddamn silly, Hilda. This is nothing but a cap full of rain. You should have seen it in 57. That was a storm." As Dr. Hale turned back onto West Broadway, a manhole cover in front of the Mueller place suddenly lifted off like the payload of a Redstone rocket. It decapitated the good doctor so quickly and neatly that he walked on another 3 steps before collapsing, dead, on the sidewalk. And the wind continued to rise. 7. Under the city, 4:15 p.m. Eddie led them through the darkened tunnels for an hour, perhaps an hour and a half, before admitting, in a tone that was more bewildered than frightened, that for the first time in his life, he was lost. They could still hear the dim thunder of water in the drains, but the acoustics of all of these tunnels was so crazed that it was impossible to tell if the water sounds were coming from ahead or behind, left or right, above or below. Their matches were gone. They were lost in the dark. Bill was scared, plenty scared. The conversation he'd had with his father in his father's shop kept coming back to him. "There's 9 pounds of blueprints that just disappeared somewhere along the line. My point is that nobody knows where all the damned sewers and drains go, or why. When they work, nobody cares. When they don't, there's 3 or 4 sad sacks from Dairy Water who have to try and find out which pump went flooey or where the plug-up is. It's dark and smelly, and there are rats. Those are all good reasons to stay out. But the best reason is that you could get lost. It's happened before. Happened before. Happened before. It's happened..." Sure it had. There was that bundle of bones and polished cotton they had passed on the way to its lair, for instance. Bill felt panic trying to rise and pushed it back. It went, but not easily. He could feel it back there, a live thing, struggling and twisting, trying to get out. Adding to it was the nagging, unanswerable question of whether they had killed it or not. Richie said yes, Mike said yes, so did Eddie. But he hadn't liked the frightened, doubtful look on Bev's face or on Stan's as the light died and they crawled back through the small door away from the susurrating, collapsing web. "So what do we do now?" Stan asked. Bill heard the frightened little boy tremble in Stan's voice and knew the question was aimed directly at him. "Yeah," Ben said. "What?" "Damn, I wish we had a flashlight or even a candle. Bill thought he heard a stifled sob in the second ellipsis. It frightened him more than anything else. Ben would have been astounded to know it, but Bill thought the fat boy tough and resourceful, steadier than Richie and less apt to cave in suddenly than Stan. If Ben was getting ready to crack, they were on the edge of very bad trouble. It was not the skeleton of the water department guy to which Bill's own mind kept returning, but to Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher, lost in McDougal's cave. He would push the thought away, and then it would come stealing back. Something else was troubling him, but the concept was too large and too vague for his tired boy's mind to grasp. Perhaps it was the very simplicity of the idea that made it elusive. They were falling away from each other. The bond that had held them all this long summer was dissolving. It had been faced and vanquished. It might be dead, as Richie and Eddie thought, or it might be wounded so badly it would sleep for 100 years or 1,000 or 10,000. They had faced it, seen it with its final mask laid aside, and it had been horrible enough, oh, for sure. But once seen, its physical form was not so bad, and its most potent weapon was taken away from it. They all had, after all, seen spiders before. They were alien and somehow crawlingly dreadful, and he supposed that none of them would ever be able to see another one, if we ever get out of this, without feeling a shudder of revulsion. But a spider was, after all, only a spider. Perhaps at the end, when the masks of horror were laid aside, there was nothing with which the human mind could not cope. That was a heartening thought. Anything except the deadlights. Whatever had been out there. But perhaps even that unspeakable living light which crouched at the doorway to the macroverse was dead or dying. The deadlights and the trip into the black to the place where they had been was already growing hazy and hard to recall in his mind. And that wasn't really the point. The point, felt but not grasped, was simply that the fellowship was ending. It was ending and they were still in the dark. That other had, through their friendship, perhaps been able to make them something more than children. But they were becoming children again. Bill felt it as much as the others. "What now, Bill?" Richie asked, finally saying it right out.
I don't know,
Bill said. His stutter was back, alive and well. He heard it, they heard it, and he stood in the dark, smelling the sodden aroma of their growing panic, wondering how long it would be before somebody, Stan most likely it would be Stan, tore things wide open by saying,
"Well, why don't you know? You got us into this."
"And what about Henry?" Mike asked uneasily. "Is he still out there, or what?"
"Oh, geez," Eddie said, almost moaned. "I forgot about him." "Sure he is. Sure he is. He's probably as lost as we are, and we could run into him any time. Geez, Bill, don't you have any ideas? Your dad works down here. Don't you have any ideas at all?"
Bill listened to the distant mocking thunder of the water and tried to have the idea that Eddie, all of them, had a right to demand. Because, yes, correct, he had gotten them into this, and it was his responsibility to get them back out again. Nothing came. Nothing.
"I have an idea," Beverly said quietly.
In the dark, Bill heard a sound he could not immediately place. A whispery little sound, but not scary. Then there was a more easily placed sound. A zipper.
What?
He thought. And then he realized what. She was undressing. For some reason, Beverly was undressing.
"What are you doing?"
Richie asked, and his shocked voice cracked on the last word.
"I know something," Beverly said in the dark, and to Bill her voice sounded older. "I know because my father told me. I know how to bring us back together. And if we're not together, we'll never get out."
"What?" Ben asked, sounding bewildered and terrified. "What are you talking about?"
"Something that will bring us together forever. Something that will show..."
No, but Beverly," Bill said, suddenly understanding everything.
"That will show that I love you all," Beverly said, "that you're all my friends."
"What she ta..." Mike began. Calmly, Beverly cut across his words.
"Who's first?" she asked. "I think..."
8. In the lair of It, 1985.
"He's dying," Beverly wept. "His arm. It ate his arm."
She reached for Bill, clung to him, and Bill shook her off.
"It's getting away again,"
he roared at her, blood-caked lips and chin. "Come on, Richie, Ben, this time we're going to finish her." Richie turned Bill toward him, looked at him as you would look at a man who was hopelessly raving.
"Bill, we have to take care of Eddie. We have to get a tourniquet on him. Get him out of here."
But Beverly was now sitting with Eddie's head in her lap, cradling him. She had closed his eyes.
"Go with Bill," she said. "If you let him die for nothing, if it comes back in another 25 years, or 50, or even 2,000. I swear I'll haunt your ghosts. Go.
Richie looked at her for a moment, indecisive. Then he became aware that her face was losing definition, becoming not a face but a pale shape in the growing shadows. The light was fading. It decided him.
All right, he said to Bill. This time we chase.
Ben was standing in back of the spider web, which had begun to decay again. He had also seen the shape swaying high up in it, and he prayed that Bill would not look up. But as the web began to fall in drifts and strands and skeins, Bill did. He saw Audra, sagging as if in a very old and creaky elevator. She dropped 10 feet, stopped, swaying from side to side, and then abruptly dropped another 15. Her face never changed. Her eyes, china blue, were wide open. Her bare feet swung back and forth like pendulums. Her hair hung lankly over her shoulders. Her mouth was ajar.
Audra, he screamed.
Bill, come on, Ben shouted.
The web was falling all around them now, thudding to the floor and beginning to run. Richie suddenly grabbed Bill around the waist and propelled him forward, shooting for a 10-foot-high gap between the floor and the bottommost cross strand of the sagging web.
Go, Bill, go, go.
That's Audra, Bill shouted desperately. That's Audra.
I don't give a shit if it's the Pope, Richie said grimly. Eddie's dead, and we're going to kill it, if it's still alive. We're going to finish the job this time, Big Bill. Either she's alive or she's not. Now come on.
Bill hung back a moment longer, and then snapshots of the children, all the dead children, seemed to flutter through his mind like lost photographs from George's album, School Friends.
All were right. Let's go. God forgive me.
He and Richie ran under the strand of cross-webbing seconds before it collapsed and joined Ben on the other side. They ran after it as Audra swung and dangled 50 feet above the stone floor, wrapped in a numbing cocoon that was attached to the decaying web. 9. Ben. They followed the trail of its black blood, oily pools of ichor that ran and dripped into the cracks between the flagstones. But as the floor began to rise toward a semicircular black opening at the far side of the chamber, Ben saw something new. A trail of eggs. Each was black and rough-shelled, perhaps as big as an ostrich egg. A waxy light shone from within them. Ben realized they were semi-transparent. He could see black shapes moving inside.
It's children, he thought, and felt his gorge rise. It's miscarried children. God.
Richie and Bill had stopped and were staring at the eggs with stupid, dazed wonder.
Go on, Ben shouted. I'll take care of them. Get it.
Here, Richie shouted, and threw Ben a pack of Dairy Town House matches. Ben caught them. Bill and Richie ran on. Ben watched them in the rapidly dimming light for a moment. They ran into the darkness of its escape passage and were lost from sight. Then he looked down at the first of the thin-shelled eggs, at the black manta-like shadow inside, and felt his determination waver.
This was too much. This was simply too awful. And surely they would die without his help. They had not been so much laid as dropped. But its time was close. And if one of them is capable of surviving, even one.
Summoning up all of his courage, summoning up Eddie's pale, dying face, Ben brought one desert driver boot down on the first egg. It broke with a sodden squelch as some stinking placenta ran out around his boot. Then a spider the size of a rat was scrabbling weakly across the floor, trying to get away. And Ben could hear it in his head, its high mewling cries like the sound of a handsaw being bent rapidly back and forth so that it makes ghost music. Ben lurched after it on legs that felt like stilts and brought his foot down again. He felt the spider's body crunch and splatter under the heel of his boot. His gorge clenched, and this time there was no way he could hold it back. He vomited, then twisted his heel, grinding the thing into the stones, listening to the cries in his head fade to nothing.
How many? How many eggs? Didn't I read somewhere that spiders can lay thousands or millions? I can't keep doing this. I'll go mad.
You have to. Come on, Ben. Get it together.
He went to the next egg and repeated the process in the last of the dying light. Everything was repeated. The brittle snap, the squelch of liquid, the final coup de grace. The next. Making his way slowly toward the black arch into which his friends had gone. The darkness was now complete, Beverly and the decaying web somewhere behind him. He could still hear the whisper of its collapse.
The eggs were pallid stones in the dark. As he reached each one, he struck a light from the matchbook and broke it open. In each case, he was able to follow the course of the dazed spiderling and crush it before the light flickered out. He had no idea how he was going to proceed if his matches gave out before he had crushed the last of the eggs and killed each one's unspeakable cargo. 10. It. 1985.
Still coming. It sensed them still coming, gaining, and its fear grew. Perhaps it was not eternal after all. The unthinkable must finally be thought. Worse, it sensed the death of its young. A third of these hated, hateful men boys was walking steadily up its trail of birth, almost insane with revulsion, but continuing nonetheless, methodically stamping the life from each of its eggs. No, it wailed, lurching from side to side, feeling its life force running from 100 wounds, none of them mortal in itself, but each a song of pain, each slowing it. One of its legs hung by a single living twist of meat. One of its eyes was blind. It sensed a terrible rupture inside, the result of whatever poison one of the hated men boys had managed to shoot down its throat. And still they came on, closing the distance. And how could this happen? It whined and mewled, and when it sensed them almost directly behind, it did the only thing it could do now. It turned to fight. 11. Beverly.
Before the last of the light faded and utter dark closed down, she saw Bill's wife plunge another 20 feet and then fetch up again. She had begun to spin, her long red hair fanning out.
His wife, she thought. But I was his first love, and if he thought some other woman was his first, it was only because he forgot. Forgot Derry.
Then she was in darkness, alone with the sound of the falling web and Eddie's simple, moveless weight. She didn't want to let him go, didn't want to let his face lie on the foul floor of this place. So she held his head in the crook of an arm that had gone mostly numb and brushed his hair away from his damp forehead. She thought of the birds. That was something she supposed she had gotten from Stan. Poor Stan, who hadn't been able to face this.
All of them. I was their first love.
She tried to remember it. It was something good to think about in all this darkness where you couldn't place the sounds. It made her feel less alone. At first it wouldn't come. The image of the birds intervened. Crows and grackles and starlings, spring birds that came back from somewhere while the streets were still running with meltwater and the last patches of crusted, dirty snow clung grimly to their shady places. It seemed to her that it was always on a cloudy day that you first heard and saw those spring birds and wondered where they came from. Suddenly they were just back in Derry, filling the white air with their raucous chatter. They lined the telephone wires and roof peaks of the Victorian houses on West Broadway. They jostled for places on the aluminum branches of the elaborate TV antenna on top of Wally Spa. They loaded the wet black branches of the elms on Lower Main Street. They settled. They talked to each other in the screamy babbling voices of old country women at the weekly Grange bingo games. And then, at some signal which humans could not discern, they all took wing at once, turning the sky black with their numbers. And came down somewhere else.
Yes, the birds. I was thinking of them because I was ashamed. It was my father who made me ashamed, I guess. And maybe that was its doing, too. Maybe.
The memory came. The memory behind the birds. But it was vague and disconnected. Perhaps this one always would be. She had... Her thoughts broke off as she realized that Eddie... 12. Love and Desire. August 10th, 1958.
Comes to her first, because he is the most frightened. He comes to her not as her friend of that summer, or as her brief lover now, but the way he would have come to his mother only 3 or 4 years ago, to be comforted. He doesn't draw back from her smooth nakedness, and at first she doubts if he even feels it. He is trembling, and although she holds him, the darkness is so perfect that even this close she cannot see him. Except for the rough cast, he might as well be a phantom.
What do you want? He asks her.
You have to put your thing in me, she says.
He tries to pull back, but she holds him and he subsides against her.
She has heard someone, then she thinks, drawing his breath. Bevy, I can't do that. I don't know how. I think it's easy, but you'll have to get undressed.
She thinks about the intricacies of managing cast and shirt, first somehow separating and then rejoining them, and amends,
Your pants, anyway.
No, I can't.
But she thinks part of him can and wants to, because his trembling has stopped, and she feels something small and hard which presses against the right side of her belly. "You can," she says, and pulls him down. The surface beneath her bare back and legs is firm, clayey dry. The distant thunder of the water is drowsy, soothing. She reaches for him. There's a moment when her father's face intervenes, harsh and forbidding. "I want to see if you're intact." And then she closes her arms around Eddie's neck, her smooth cheek against his smooth cheek, and as he tentatively touches her small breasts, she sighs and thinks for the first time, "This is Eddie." And she remembers a day in July. Could it only have been last month? When no one else turned up in the Barrens but Eddie, and he had a whole bunch of Little Lulu comic books, and they read together for most of the afternoon. Little Lulu looking for beebleberries and getting in all sorts of crazy situations. Witch Hazel, all of those guys. It had been fun. She thinks of birds, in particular of the grackles and starlings and crows that come back in the spring, and her hands go to his belt and loosen it. And he says again that he can't do that. She tells him that he can. She knows he can. And what she feels is not shame or fear now, but a kind of triumph. "Where?" he says, and that hard thing pushes urgently against her inner thigh. "Here," she says. "Bevy, I'll fall on you," he says, and she hears his breath start to whistle painfully. "I think that's sort of the idea," she tells him, and holds him gently and guides him. He pushes forward too fast, and there is pain. She draws her breath in, her teeth biting at her lower lip, and thinks of the birds again, the spring birds, lining the roof peaks of the houses, taking wing all at once under low March clouds. "Beverly," he says uncertainly, "are you okay?" "Go slower," she says. "It'll be easier for you to breathe." He does move more slowly, and after a while his breathing speeds up, but she understands this is not because there is anything wrong with him. The pain fades. Suddenly he moves more quickly, then stops, stiffens, and makes a sound, some sound. She senses that this is something for him, something extraordinarily special, something like flying. She feels powerful. She feels a sense of triumph rise up strongly within her. Is this what her father was afraid of? Well, he might be. There was power in this act, all right, a chain-breaking power that was blood deep. She feels no physical pleasure, but there is a kind of mental ecstasy in it for her. She senses the closeness. He puts his face against her neck and she holds him. He's crying. She holds him and feels the part of him that made a connection between them begin to fade. It is not leaving her exactly. It is simply fading, becoming less. When his weight shifts away, she sits up and touches his face in the darkness. "Did you?" "Did I what?" "Whatever it is, I don't know exactly." He shakes his head. She feels it with her hand against his cheek. "I don't think it was exactly like, you know, like the big boys say. But it was really something." He speaks so low the others can't hear. "I love you, Bevy." Her consciousness breaks down a little there. She's quite sure there's more talk, some whispered, some loud, and can't remember what is said. It doesn't matter. Does she have to talk each of them into it all over again? Yes, probably. But it doesn't matter. They have to be talked into it. This essential human link between the world and the infinite, the only place where the bloodstream touches eternity. It doesn't matter. What matters is love and desire. Here in this dark is as good a place as any. Better than some, maybe. Mike comes to her, then Richie, and the act is repeated. Now she feels some pleasure, dim heat in her childish, unmatured sex, and she closes her eyes as Stan comes to her and she thinks of the birds, spring and the birds, and she sees them again and again, all lighting at once, filling up the winter naked trees, shockwave riders on the moving edge of nature's most violent season. She sees them take wing again and again, the flutter of their wings like the snap of many sheets on the line, and she thinks, a month from now, every kid in Derry Park will have a kite. They'll run to keep the strings from getting tangled with each other. She thinks again, this is what flying is like. With Stan, as with the others, there is that rueful sense of fading, of leaving, with whatever they truly need from this act, some ultimate, close but as yet unfound. Did you? She asks again, and although she doesn't know exactly what it is, she knows that he hasn't. There was a long wait, and then Ben comes to her. He is trembling all over. But it is not the fearful trembling she felt in Stan. Beverly, I can't, he says in a tone which purports to be reasonable and is anything but.
You can, too. I can feel it.
She sure can. There's more of this hardness, more of him. She can feel it below the gentle push of his belly. Its size raises a certain curiosity, and she touches the bulge lightly. He groans against her neck, and the blow of his breath causes her bare body to dimple with goosebumps. She feels the first twist of real heat race through her. Suddenly, the feeling in her is very large. She recognizes that it is too big.
And is he too big? Can she take that into herself?
And too old for her. Something, some feeling that walks in boots.
This is like Henry's M-80s, something not meant for kids, something that could explode and blow you up.
But this was not the place or time for worry.
Here there was love, desire, and the dark. If they didn't try for the first two, they would surely be left with the last.
Beverly, don't.
Yes.
I...
Show me how to fly,
she says with a calmness she doesn't feel, aware by the fresh, wet warmth on her cheek and neck that he has begun to cry.
Show me, Ben.
No.
If you wrote the poem, show me. Feel my hair if you want to, Ben. It's all right.
Beverly, I...
He's not just trembling now. He's shaking all over. But she senses again that this ague is not all fear. Part of it is the precursor of the throw this act is all about. She thinks of
the birds.
His face, his dear, sweet, earnest face, and knows it is not fear. It is wanting, he feels, a deep, passionate wanting now barely held in check. And she feels that sense of power again, something like flying, something like looking down from above and seeing all the birds on the roof peaks, on the TV antenna atop Wally's, seeing streets spread out map-like. Oh, desire, right, this was something. It was love and desire that taught you to fly.
Ben, yes,
she cries suddenly, and the leash breaks. She feels pain again, and for a moment there is the frightening sensation of being crushed. Then he props himself up on the palms of his hands, and that feeling is gone.
He's big, oh yes. The pain is back, and it's much deeper than when Eddie first entered her.
She has to bite her lip again and think of the birds until the burning is gone.
But it does go, and she is able to reach up and touch his lips with one finger, and he moans. The heat is back, and she feels her power suddenly shift to him. She gives it gladly and goes with it.
There is a sensation first of being rocked, of a delicious spiraling sweetness, which makes her begin to turn her head helplessly from side to side, and a tuneless humming comes from between her closed lips.
This is flying. This. Oh, love, oh, desire. Oh, this is something impossible to deny. Binding, giving, making a strong circle. Binding, giving, flying.
End of side 28. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.